Sanyo X Wings Commander Q.
36 Shizu Ify Commander K.
36 X Wings Commander Q. 3.
And spirit and all right,
thank you. Riding on Interstate 81, approaching Interstate 80 in the next short while. Well, it seems like we're passing through hills and valleys. Along this road, there's lots of construction going on. There are these orange and white barrels, some of which are knocked over. Maybe it's like knocking over mailboxes with a bat. There's lots of sky. And, so now punctuated by interruptions for cool things that might show up. Got a copy of the Tribune, Scranton, Pennsylvania. And their lead story today is, new curfew puts brakes on teen drivers. The state regulations take effect today, by Faith Gallet, Tribune regional staff. Brandon Stressburger, that'd be a good name for someone who's always worried. He's just a stress burger. Sorry. That's rude. Oh, nice. Brandon Stressburger worries, yeah, how he'll get home from work now that the first in a series of new state regulation aimed at teen drivers take effect today. The 17-year-old concession stand worker from East Mountain says the new law, which requires teens with junior driver licenses to be off the road by 11 p.m. is going to take a toll on his part-time job at the Lackawanna County Stadium, which we passed. The law also requires 16 and 17-year-old drivers to stay off the streets until 5 a.m. the next day. The state's previous deadline had been midnight. Isn't that the point of a curfew?
Yeah.
That you get off by a certain time and that you can't be on again until a certain time?
Yeah, that would be the definition of a curfew.
The state's previous deadline had been midnight. The new curfew applies to learner's permit holders as well. In June, Governor Tom Ridge signed the young driver laws, which also state drivers under 18 cannot have more passengers than there are seat belts in the vehicle.
Doesn't that fall under the seatbelt law?
I don't know. But apparently, it probably is something that they would be more likely to enforce if it's a young driver.
Yeah.
It's like, you know that other law that we don't enforce? Well, with you guys, we're going to enforce it.
It's the point that we intend to. Here's a new law just for you.
Here's a new law just for you.
Don't you feel special?
The sound of Harley's passing by. Oh, they're loaded up. Look at that.
Yeah, careful, guys. I think that's a Marx stadium that
we've heard
of. John Law, my brother was in.
Yeah, it's John Law. They look pretty. They look all right. They're not going that fast.
They're not going a little faster than
the are they? They're loaded up.
Yeah.
They got the backpacks and all that. They got the old kind of helmets. Okay, let's see. Extending the nighttime driving restriction will help keep teens off the road during the dangerous nighttime hours. State Transportation Secretary Bradley Mallory said, many serious crashes occur between 11 p.m. and midnight. Brandon and his friends believe the new law may cause teen drivers to become reckless. I don't see how it's going to help because kids who work at night are going to be flying to get home earlier and they're going to crash, he said. God, by the time we clean up and stuff, it's usually later than 11 o'clock. During the winter, Brandon trades in evenings at the baseball stadium for another part-time job at the Montage Mountain Ski Resort, which we also passed. So, blah, 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 that goes on. So the teens are being restricted in, is this Eastern Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
I guess it's all of Pennsylvania. They're being put down, man. Dow smashes old record on eve of Fed Reserve meeting. The Dow Jones Industrial Average soared to a new record Monday as investors banished fears. Tell me how my news reading voice is. As investors banished fears that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates repeatedly in its bid to quell inflation. In a broad-based...
It needs to be deeper.
Yes. In a broad-based, steady advance, the Dow rose 199.15 to close at 11,299.76, easily surpassing its July 16th record close of 11,209.84. With Monday's gains, the Dow was up 23% for the year. See the Heinlein's theory. The Dow is going up and the skirts are coming down. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Monday's rally occurred on light volume as many traders were on vacation and many investors stayed on the sidelines awaiting the Fed's announcement on interest rates this afternoon. Nonetheless, the rally lifted most sectors, with fledgling internet companies, battered drug stocks, and multinational consumer companies all rising. So you better invest in LSD soon. Or it's too expensive. Okay, so that's the front page. Let's get to the weird local stuff. You know, cat rescues firemen and that kind of thing. Second busiest day.
Mine tour.
A motorcycle group helps swell the Saturday attendance to 914. One by one, the hogs rumbled up. The hogs rumbled up Snake Road and veered into McDade Park. Although it looked like a scene straight out of an old Marlon Brando film, the men and women dismounted their Harley-Davidson motorcycles and brought tickets to the Lackawanna coal mine. The members... What? Was it the Stripey Rocks? What? Mine Tour notes second busiest day. Motorcycle group helps swell the Saturday attendance to 914 by Rich Mates, Tribune staff writer. One by one, the hogs rumbled up Snake Road and veered into McDade Park. Although it looked like a scene straight out of an old Marlon Brando film, the men and women dismounted their Harley-Davidson motorcycles and bought tickets at the Lackawanna coal mine. The members of the Harley Owners Group, which was meeting at Montage this past weekend, helped make Saturday and Sunday one of the busiest weekends in the history of the mine tour. The 914 tourists at the attraction Saturday made it the second busiest day in the model mine's history. adding in Sunday's 518 visitors, the weekend's tally of 1,432 visitors was 300 to 400 persons higher than usual. Lackawanna coal mine, visited by hogs. That's the kind of,
Sorry, cursing at a driver, did it get on your story?
No. You can curse, feel free to curse at drivers, that'll be background, thing, let's see. Okay, one more. Oh, and let's see. It appears the Tribune is running a series of stories called Drought 99. A couple of weeks ago, Carol Barthome, this story was written by Christopher Kelly, Farmers, Customers, and Short Supply, from the Drought 99 series. A couple of weeks ago, Carol Barthome was watching her rain-starved soil dry up and wondering how she would fill her tables at the Scranton Cooperative Farmers Market. Then the problem was supply. Now the Clark Summit farmer says the problem is demand. While the drought has badly burned most area farmers, many still have good fresh produce for sale. But the crowds that used to pack the market on Albright Avenue have all but dried out, Mrs. Bartolome said Monday. We have a nice variety of stuff here. Everybody does, she said as she prepared to haul most of her variety back to the farm. The potatoes aren't real big, but they're nice. And look at those peppers, they're beautiful, and we have plenty to sell. It's the crowds that have dried up. She's right about the peppers, large and plump and lining most of the booths from one end of the market to the other. That the eye can follow the shiny chain of bright reds and greens largely without interruption indicates she's right about the customers, too. I don't know if it's because of all the bad news over the drought or what, but people aren't coming out the way they used to, Mrs. Bartolome said. Last year was just phenomenal. This year I think people are thinking we don't have anything to sell. We have lost a lot of our crops, but it could have been a lot worse. We're pleased with what we've been able to save. We want people to know it's down there. And it goes on and on, and they talk to a guy named Bob Saravallo. He says his peaches may be small, his apples and peaches may be small, but he contends the extra sun they've had has raised their sugar content, making them some of the sweetest and juiciest you'll find anywhere. These are excellent, he said, holding out a ripe red and gold peach. They're some of the best we've had in years, but here we are loading them back onto the truck. When this is how you make your living, that's not the way you want to end your day. Poor farmers. Forecast for today in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Patchy fog early, then clouds and sun, high 83. Tonight, some clouds, more humid, stray shower, low 63. And if it's under 18, it'd better be home by 11. Wednesday, clouds and some sun, a shower around. Thursday, variable clouds, perhaps shower, high 79, low 65. Oh, national forecast would be more relevant for us. What are we driving into? That would be good to know. Let's see. Let's see. Well, Boston is 84 and 67 sunny. Hartford 88 and 62 sunny. Philadelphia 86 and 68, partly cloudy. Chicago 76 and 64 showers. Oh, this is helpful. National forecast. There it is. All right, great. Car is exiting exit 81, Interstate 81, and now getting onto Interstate 80, which is going to take us all the way there.
Okay.
Interstate 80 is going to take us from Pennsylvania to Nevada. Figure that out. National forecast. Thunder, showers and thunderstorms, some with heavy rain and strong wind, will extend from Michigan to Arkansas. And Tennessee today, as a storm system crosses the Midwest. Dry warm weather with some sunshine in contrast will cover the Northeast. Temperatures will reach the 80s this afternoon. Farther west, very warm weather with sunshine is on tap between the Rockies and the West Coast. While most locations stay dry, a thunderstorm will blossom here and there, mainly over the higher elevations. Temperatures will soar into the 80s and 90s in many areas, while 100s again roasting the southwest deserts. How is it in Nevada? One might ask. Did you ask?
How is it in Nevada?
Okay. it's in the 90s.
Cool.
It's in the 90s. Balmy. Let's see, Reno. Do they have one for Reno? No. Okay. How about Las Vegas? Las Vegas. Las Vegas, which isn't exactly the part of Nevada we're going to, but Las Vegas is 104 and a high, 80 a low, and partly cloudy. For today. For tomorrow, 104 and 80, partly cloudy. For Thursday, 109 and a low, 80.
At night,
it's
not 80.
Okay. And for the area we're in right now, a southeast flow of air will eventually lead to more opportunities for rainfall in the form of showers and thunderstorms. A developing system in the tropical Atlantic could play a role in the region's weather late in the week into the weekend. Patchy fog early today, otherwise mixed clouds and sunshine with a stray shower, high 83. And that's probably all that's relevant. And finally, in the news, kids have a vested interest in back-to-school styles. Out, baggy jeans, backpacks, and micro mini skirts. In, flight pants, sling packs, and vests.
What is that?
Oh, okay. Once again, the malls are teeming with back-to-school shoppers as area school children, much to their parents' chagrin, attempt to outdo each other while vying for their school's best dressed award. It's enough to send even the most tranquil parents spiraling into the depths of madness, or at least praying for a dress code. But knowing what's in and where to get it may help alleviate the ever-nefarious dressing room meltdown. And heck, if your kids hear you warble off, I really think those carpenter cords would look much better paired with that tech vest. They might actually think you are cool. Might is the key word here. Gleaning advice from teen fashion magazines, area retailers, and from the kids themselves, we've assembled a list of those fashion trends that will be cropping up in schoolyards and on college campuses this fall. Not since Mark from Ork donned his ski coat variety on national television has the unisex puff vest received such attention. Old Navy's tech vest with its hip-to-zip motto is flying off store shelves, as are the Gap's Pro Fleece and Chanel quilted vests and Express Techno puff vest. Tommy Hilfiger, whose line is available in department stores like Kaufman's and Boscobe's, is also offering a reversible puff vest in his signature primary colors. All right, so there's that. It appears as though the enormously baggy jeans variety is going the way of the dodo. In their stead are slimmer-fitting styles with flared bottoms and, for girls, touches of embroidery. Oh my God. Dark denim is especially popular, said Kaufman's visual merchandising manager, Dennis Gustitidis. Visual merchandising manager. We're recommending that parents wash them inside out in order for them to retain color. Cuffs are also making a comeback, especially those with a bigger is better attitude. Oh, so it's instead of baggy jeans, it's cuffs. Big cuffs. Hot pants. Cargo and carpenter pants with their loops and pockets will see some competition in the form of flight pants this year. Made of nylon, styles feature zipper accents, drawstring waists, and big pockets. But they're not the obnoxious varieties we saw in the 80s, Mr. Gustitidis assured. For girls, khakis, capris, and walking shorts are also looking to retain their popularity this fall. And for boys, flat front pants with straight legs look to be gaining momentum as well. Blah, blah, blah. Parents rejoice. Hip-hugging minis are out with some skirt lengths dropping from thigh to ankle, though most rest just above the knee. A line or straight cut seems to be the skirt of choice, especially those with details like cargo pockets or drawstrings. Shoe styles for girls run across the board from platform sneakers to Mary Janes. It all depends on what I'm wearing, answers Jessup's Tracy Martin, 15, when asked what style she prefers in the JCPenney shoe department. I like clunky heels if I'm wearing a skirt, or dress in platform sneakers if I'm wearing baggy carpenter pants, or bell-bottoms. I usually get at least 5 pairs of shoes when I go back to school shopping. Guys, on the other hand, will be looking for their usual staple of a pair of sneakers along with every trendy lug-soled Oxfords and hiking boots. And we're just passing by an open field of grass with a nice line of trees behind it, which is probably more interesting and relevant than platform sneakers could ever be. That's the news for now. Goodbye.
It's 3:23 p.m. Stopped just past... Stopped at a rest area right now, just past exit 21 off of I-80, Pennsylvania. At a picnic table, among many picnic tables. And this picnic table is surrounded by oak tree, maple tree, locust tree, and what was the other one?
Birch.
Oak, maple, birch, and locust. The weather is overcast, breezy, cool. This is most definitely a truck stop. There are lots of trucks here. And we just ate a kind of a picnic lunch gotten from an IGA supermarket. We had chicken, 3 potato salad, and lima bean salad. All of which are really good. It's funny that at a place like this, the sound of the traffic probably never stops. It's kind of a whoosh, kind of a squeal. Sometimes it's almost a moan. But it goes on and on. One of the things I wanted to mention was regarding perspectives on the Northeast as we are traveling away from the Northeast. The Northeast, especially the cities, they're very crowded. And even the suburbs, the whole area, I mean, not all of New England is crowded, but much of the area from, let's say, Boston down to Washington, D.C., what they call the power corridor, is very crowded. And I think it strongly affects how people live, how they think, and how they act, how they treat each other, how they treat nature. It doesn't make everybody who lives in the Northeast a homogenous bunch, but it has its effect down in the bones, I think. To be always in traffic jams, crowded on the subways, always a line at every restaurant or store you go to. It seems like wherever you stand, there's someone approaching you whose way you're in. Much more combative. People forge psychical spaces around themselves, often to compensate even if it doesn't work, but to try and compensate for physical spaces that they are not given. If you live in a large apartment building in a small apartment, if your car is parked in a parking lot, if you're in a traffic jam, if you're on a crowded subway, if you're always in crowded stores, at some point, you're invaded. The world is over your border, over your mental, physical, psychical border. And it almost becomes kind of like a siege between trying to have some kind of space that's your own, that you can move freely about in, like water, like swimming in water, and the rest, where you're shoved here and directed and pushed, and it gets very insidious, because it's not just physical, it's also social. There's a social crowdedness to the Northeast, as well as a physical crowdedness to the Northeast. And I'm not saying that the social crowdedness is not, the social invasion, psychosocial invasion is not true of other areas, because I think it is, it just manifests in different ways, but if you can't walk away from these kind of things because the area you live in is just too crowded and noisy and smoky and filled with machines on wheels and other kinds of machines, then, and you have no breathing space that you can go to easily and daily if you need to, the mind becomes constricted. And a mind constricted will still be as free as it can be and as independent as it can be, but it's harder. The great philosophers have always talked about people's relationships with nature as being very important, and I think in order to have a good relationship with nature, at least one point toward that is being able to sit somewhere where you feel that the piece of nature around you in that moment in that place is yours. You don't own it per se, but it's it's for the time being, there's no one around, and you're enjoying it completely. And you can think your thoughts and not feel other human presences around that would have a sort of an interfering effect at that moment. Cities have parks, but parks in the Northeast always seem to be full, crowded with tourists and with locals and with events and things like that. Parks are used for things other than for congregating with natural things. They're used for events. And it's different other places where a stretch of nature is just a stretch of nature. It's going to be there whether anybody's there or not. And the possibility of being there alone with it is much greater. So anyway, these are some of the thoughts on perspective on the Northeast. Not far, very far away from the Northeast, still in probably central Pennsylvania, but already the landscape has changed and the demeanor of the people encountered is a little bit looser, a little bit friendlier. Not perfect, not idyllic, just the screws are a little bit less tight, which is a good thing. More later.
36X with Commander Q.
36X with Commander Q.
36X with Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all right.
Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in the most delightful way. In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. Your job's a game, and every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in the most delightful way. Thank you. gathering his nest has very little time to rest. While gathering his bits of twine and twig, though quite intent in his pursuit, he has a merry tune to toot. He knows a song will move a job along.
Continuing on Tuesday, August 24th, 1999, 4:47 p.m., Interstate 80 West, and in terms of location, 6 miles east of Brookville, Pennsylvania, and 24 miles east of Clarion, Pennsylvania, according to a road marker. Okay, time for some more readings from Robert Heinlein. Time enough for love.
Now, if I sit here and read like this, how does this sound like the machine
squelched over there?
We will have questions somewhere in there.
Yes, we'll be somewhere in there. Yes, I want to note here that at approximately the time, if all goes well, that the series of tapes I've been making for the first week of, for the first of three reports from the road for my Within's Within show, the first report will be played Saturday at noon on the 28th, which is approximately the time that Mio and I will be arriving in Nevada, possibly even nearing Black Rock Desert by that point. So by the time you hear this, John Murphy and whoever else may be listening out there in Radio Land back there in Cambridge, my friend and I will be to our destination, or at least near it, very close to our destination. Interesting thought. In terms of temporal aspects. Okay, time enough for love. Oops, what did I do? Lost my page. Lost my page. DiCapo 2. Here we go. Okay. DiCapo 3 Marine. Mr. Theodore Bronson, named Woodrow Wilson Smith, a.k.a. Lazarus Long, left his apartment on Armor Boulevard and drove his car, a Ford Langelet, to a corner on 31st Street, where he parked it in a shed behind a pawn shop, as he took a dim view of leaving an automobile on the street at night. Not that the car had cost Lazarus much. He had acquired it as the result of the belief of an optimist from Denver that aces back-to-back plus a pair showing could certainly beat a pair of jacks. Mr. Jenkins must be bluffing, but Mr. Jenkins had a jack in the hole, Mr. Jenkins being Lazarus. It had been a profitable winter, and Lazarus expected a still more profitable spring. His guess about a war market on certain stocks and commodities had usually been correct, and his spread of investments was wide enough that a wrong guess did not hurt him much, as most of his guesses were right. They could hardly be wrong, since he had anticipated stepped-up submarine warfare, knowing what it would eventually bring this country into the war in Europe. Watching the market left him time for other quote-unquote investments in other people's optimism, sometimes at pool, sometimes at cards. He enjoyed pool more, found cards more rewarding. All winter he played both, and his plain and rather friendly face, which, when decorated with his best stupid look, marked him as a natural sucker, a look he enhanced by dressing as a hayseed come to town. Lazarus did not mind other pool hall hustlers, or quote-unquote mechanics in card games, or quote-unquote reader cards. He simply kept quiet and accepted any build-up winnings offered him, then, quote, lost his nerve, end quote, and dropped out before the kill. He enjoyed these crooked games. It was easier and pleasanter to take money from a thief than it was to play an honest game to win, and it did not cost as much sleep. He always dropped out of a crooked game early, even when he was behind, but his timing was rarely that bad. Cook Forest State Park.
Huxitani, where the groundhog lives.
Huxitani? Phil?
Yeah.
Pete? What is it?
Phil.
Huxitani Phil, the groundhog. Winnings he reinvested in the market. All winter he had stayed under the name Red Jenkins, living at the YMCA and spending almost nothing. When the weather was very bad, he stayed in Red, avoiding the steep and icy streets. He had forgotten how harsh a Kansas City winter could be. Once he saw a team of big horses trying gallantly to haul a heavy truck up the steep pitch of 10th Street above Grand Avenue. The off horse slipped on the ice and broke a leg. Lazarus heard the cannon bone pop. It made him feel sick, and he wanted to horsewhip the teamster. Why had the fool taken the long way around? Such days were best spent in his room or in the main public library near the YMCA. Hundreds of thousands of real books, bound books he could hold in his hands. They tempted him almost into neglecting his pursuit of money. During that cruel winter, he spent every spare hour there, getting reacquainted with his oldest friends. Mark Twain with Dan Beard's illustrations, Dr. Conan Doyle, The Marvelous Land of Oz as described by the Royal Historian and portrayed in color by John R. Neill, Rudyard Kipling, Herbert George Wells, Jules Verne. Lazarus felt that he could easily spend all the coming 10 years in that wonderful building. But when fall spring arrived, he started thinking about moving out of the business district and again changing his persona. It was becoming difficult to get picked as a sucker either at pool or at poker. His investment program was complete. He had enough cash in Fidelity Savings and Trust Bank to allow him to give up the austerity of the YMCA, find a better address, and show a more prosperous face to the world, essentially to his final purpose in the city, which is re-meeting his first family, and not much time left before his July deadline. Acquiring a presentable motor car crystallized his plans. He spent the next day becoming Theodore Bronson, moved his bank account one street over to the Missouri Savings Bank, and held out ample cash, visited a barber and had his hair and mustache restyled, went to Browning King & Company and bought clothing suitable to a conservative young businessman. Then he drove south and cruised Linwood Boulevard watching for vacancy signs. His requirements were simple: a furnished apartment with a respectable address and facade, its own kitchen and bathroom, and in walking distance of a pool hall on 31st Street. And the traffic has slowed. It's much, much slowed. Why, we've slowed to a stop.
Work area. Where some work is actually being done.
All right. He did not plan to hustle in that pool hall. It was one of two places where he hoped to meet a member of his first family. Lazarus found what he needed, but on Armour Boulevard rather than Linwood, and rather far from that pool hall. This caused him to rent two garaging spaces, difficult as Kansas City was not yet accustomed to supplying housing for automobiles. But $2 a month got him space in a barn close to his apartment, $3 a month got him a shed behind the pawn shop next to the Idle Hour billiard parlor. He started a routine: spend each evening from 8 to 10 at the pool hall, attend the church on Linwood Boulevard that his family had attended and did attend, go downtown mornings when business required by streetcar. Lazarus considered an automobile a nuisance in downtown Kansas City, and he enjoyed riding streetcars. He began profit-taking on his investments, converting the proceeds into gold double eagles and saving them in a lockbox in a third bank, the Commonwealth. He expected to complete liquidation with enough gold to carry him through November 11th, 1918, well before his July departure date. In his spare time, he kept the Longulette shining, took care of its upkeep himself, and drove it for pleasure. He also works slowly, carefully, and very privately on a tailoring job, making a chamois skin vest that was nothing but pockets, each to hold one $20 gold piece. When completed and filled and pockets sewed shut, he planned to cover it inside and out with a suit vest he had used as a pattern. It would be much too warm, but a money belt was not enough for that much gold, and money that clinked instead of rustled was the only sort he was certain he could use outside the country in wartime. Besides, when filled, it would be an almost bulletproof vest. One never knew what lay around the next corner, and those Latin American countries were volatile. Each Saturday afternoon, he took conversational Spanish from a Westport High School teacher who lived nearby. All in all, he kept pleasantly busy and on schedule. That evening, after locking his Ford Langulette into the shed back of the pawn shop, Lazarus glanced into a Beers tube adjoining it, thinking that his grandfather might have a stein of Mulbach there before going home. The problem of how to meet his first family easily and naturally had occupied his mind from time to time all winter. He wanted to be accepted as a friend in there, that is, his home, but he could not walk up the front steps, twist the doorbell, and announce himself as a long-lost cousin, nor even as a friend of a friend from Paducah. He had no connections with which to swing it, and if he tried a complex lie, he was certain his grandfather would spot it. Thus, he had decided on a pianissimo double approach, the church attended by his family, except his grandfather, and the hangout his grandfather used when he wanted to get away from his daughter's family. Lazarus was sure of the church, and his memory was confirmed the first Sunday he had gone there with a shock that had upset him even more than the shock of learning that he was 3 years early. He saw his mother and had momentarily mistaken her for one of his twin sisters. But almost instantly he realized why. Maureen Johnson Smith was the genetic mother of his identicals, as certainly as she was his own mother. Nevertheless, it had shaken him, and he was glad to have several hymns and a long sermon in which to try to calm down. He avoided looking at her and spent the time trying to sort out his brothers and sisters. Twice since he had seen his mother at church, and now could look at her without flinching, could even see that this pretty young matron was compatible with his faded image of what his mother ought to look like. But he still felt that he would never have recognized her had it not been for a sharp recollection of Lepis Lazuli and Lorelei Lee. He had illogically expected a much older woman, more as she had been when he had left home. Attending church had not resulted in his meeting her, or his siblings, although the pastor had introduced him to other parishioners. But he continued to drive his automobile to church against the day when it might be polite to offer her and his siblings a ride home, 6 blocks over on Benton Boulevard. The spring weather could not always be dry. He had not been as certain of his grandfather's hangout. He was sure that this was where Gramp used to go 10 or 12 years later, but did he go here when Woody Smith was, that is not yet 5? Having checked the German beer parlor and noted it had suddenly changed its name to the Swiss Garden, he went into the pool hall. Pool tables were all in use. He went back to the rear where there was one billiard table, a card table, and one for chess or checkers. No pool game being available, it seemed a good time to practice some mistakes at 3 cushion. Gramp! His grandfather was alone at the chess table. Lazarus recognized him at once. Lazarus did not break stride. He went on toward the cue rack, hesitated as he was about to pass the chess table, looked down at the array. Ira Johnson looked up. Ira? Wait a minute. Ira? I thought Ira was that guy from the, like, the...
That's Ira Weatherup.
Oh. And this is another Ira.
This is Gramp.
Ira Johnson looked up, seemed to recognize Lazarus, seemed about to speak, and then to think the better of it. "Excuse me," said Lazarus. "I didn't mean to interrupt." "No harm," said the old man. How old? To Lazarus, he seemed both older and younger than he ought to be, and smaller. When was he born? Almost 10 years before the Civil War. "I was just fiddling with a chess problem," he said. "How many moves to main? You play?" "Some," Lazarus added. "My grandfather taught me, but I haven't played lately." Clarion.
Crosses.
Oh, crosses. Oh, Lord.
Not yellow, though.
Starting to see crosses at the side of the road.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
My grandfather taught me.
Oh, yes. But I haven't played lately. Care for a game? If you want to put up with a rusty player. Ira Johnson picked up a white one and a black, put them behind his back, brought them out in his fists. Lazarus pointed, found that he had chosen the black. Cramp started setting up pieces. My name is Johnson, he offered. I'm Ted Bronson, sir. They shook hands. Ira Johnson advanced his king's pawn to four. Lazarus answered in kind. They played silently. By the sixth move, Lazarus suspected that his grandfather was recreating one of Steinitz's master games. By the ninth, he was sure of it. Should he use the escape door had discovered? No, that would feel like cheating. Of course a computer could play better chess than a man. He concentrated on playing as well as possible without attempting Dora's subtle variation. Lazarus was checkmated on White's 29th move, and it seemed to him that the master game had been perfectly reproduced. Wilhelm Steinitz against some Russian. What was his name? Must ask Dora. He waved to a marker, started to pay for the game. His grandfather pushed the coin aside, insisted on paying for the use of the table, and added to the marker, Son, fetch us two sarsaparillas. That suit you, Mr. Bronson? Or the boy can fetch us a beer from those Huns next door. Huns. Sarsaparilla's fine, thank you. Ready for revenge? After I catch my breath, you play a tough game, Mr. Johnson. Humph, you said you were rusty. I am, but my grandfather taught me when I was very young, then played me every day for years. Do tell. I have a grandson I play. Tyke isn't in school yet, but I spot him only a horse. Maybe he would play me, even. You'll allow him a night, same as I do, Mr. Johnson. Paid for the drinks, tipped the boy a nickel. What business are you, Mr. Bronson, if you don't mind my asking? Not at all. In business for myself. Buy things, sell things, make a little, lose a little. So, when are you going to sell me the Brooklyn Bridge? Sorry, sir, I unloaded that last week. But I can offer you a bargain in Spanish prisoners. Mr. Johnson smiled sourly. Guess that'll teach me. Need to switch tape sides.
Daniel X with Commander Q.
36 XUIF Commander Q.
36 X with Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all right,
Chim chimity, chim chimity, chim chim cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim chimity, chim chimity, chim chim cheroo. Good luck will rub off when I shake hands with you. Oh, blow me a kiss. And that's lucky too. Now as the ladder of life has been strung, you may think a sweep's on the bottom most rung. Though I spends me time in the ashes and smoke, in this old world there's no happier bloke. Chim chimity, chim chimity, chim chim cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim chimity, chim chimity, chim chim cheroo. Good luck will rub off when I shake hands with you. I choose me bristles with pride, yes I do. A broom for the shaft and a brush for the flue. Though I'm covered with soot from the head to me toes, a sweep nose is welcome wherever he goes. Chim chimity, chim chimity, chim chim cherry. When you're with a sweep, you're in glad company. Nowhere is there a more happier crew than them what sings chim chim cherry chim cheroo. Chim chimony chim chim cherry chim cheroo.
But Mr. Johnson, if I told you I was a pool hall hustler, you wouldn't let me play chess with your grandson. Might not. Shall we set up? Your turn for white. With the first moving allowing him to control the pace, Lazarus made a slow, careful buildup of his attack. His grandfather was equally careful, left no openings in his defense. They were so evenly matched that it took Lazarus 41 moves and much skull sweat to turn his first move advantage into a mate. I know, what if we put up the windows and put on the air conditioner? Because the wind is noisy, but it's hot otherwise. And I'll try not to trick you. When we get the air conditioning on, I open up the window.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's fine. Oh, this is nice. This reminds me of Oswego. except it's your car.
Yeah.
Your car. Okay. Let's see. Where was it? Oh, here we go. That's nice. That's perfect. Okay. Okay, so Ira Johnson says, play off the tie. No. Lazarus says play off the tie. Ira Johnson shook his head. Two games a night is my limit. Two like that is over my limit. Thank you, sir. You play a fine game for a man who is rusty. He pushed back his chair. Time for me to head for the stable. It's raining. So I noticed. I'll stand in the doorway and watch for the 31st Street trolley. I have my automobile here. I'd be honored to run you home. Eh? No need to. Only a block from the car line at the other end, and if I get a little damp, I'll be home and can get dry. More like four blocks and you'll be soaked, Graham. Mr. Johnson, I'm going to crank up that flavor anyhow to go home myself. It's no trouble to drop you anywhere. I like to drive. In about 3 minutes, I'll pull up in front and honk. If you're there, fine. If you aren't, I'll assume you prefer not to accept rides from strangers and will take no offense. Don't be touchy. Where's your automobile? I'll come with you. No, please. No need for us both to go out in the rain for a one-man job. I'll slide out the back through the alley. Then I'll be at the curb almost before you reach the front door. Lazarus decided to be stubborn. Graham could smell a mouse farther than a cat could and would wonder why Ted Bronson kept a garage at hand when he claimed to live a driving distance away. Bad. How are you going to handle this, bub? You've got to tell Grandpa Passel of lies or you'll never get inside that house, your own home, to meet the rest of your family. But complexity is contrary to the basic principle of successful lying, and Grandpa's the very man who taught me that. Yet the truth could not serve, and keeping silent was just as useless. How are you going to solve this, when Grandpa's as suspicious as you are and twice as shrewd? Ira Johnson stood up. Thank you, Mr. Bronson. I'll be at the front door. By the time Lazarus had his logulette cranked, he had settled on tactics and outlined a long-range policy. A. Drive around the block. This wagon should be wet. B. Don't use this shed again. Better to have this puddle jumper stolen than to leave a hole in your cover story. C. When you surrender the shed, see if Uncle Dattelbaum has an old set of chessmen. D. Make your lies fit what you've said, including that too hasty truth you taught about who taught you to play chess. E. Tell as much truth as possible, even if it doesn't sound good. But damn it, you should be a foundling, and that doesn't fit having a grandfather, unless you invent complexities, any one of which might snap back and catch you out. When Lazarus sounded the klaxon, Ira Johnson darted out and scrambled in. Where now? Asked Lazarus. His grandfather explained how to reach his daughter's home, and added, pretty ritzy rig to call a flivver. I got a good price for the Brooklyn Bridge. Should I swing up to Linwood or follow the car tracks? Suit yourself. Since you unloaded the bridge, you might tell me about these Spanish prisoners. Good investment? Lazarus concentrated a while on getting his vehicle headed down the tracks while avoiding the tracks themselves. Mr. Johnson, I evaded your question about what I do for a living. Your business. I really have hustled pool. Again, your business. And I ran out and let you pay the table fee a second time, as well as letting you pay for the pop. I did not intend to. So? 30 cents plus a nickel tip. Knock off 5 cents the streetcar would have cost me. That makes your half 15 cents. If it worries you, drop it in his cup the next time you pass a blind man. I'm getting a chauffeured ride on a wet night. Cheap. This is hardly a jitney bus. Very well, sir. I wanted to get straight with you, because I enjoyed the games and hope to play you again. The pleasure was mutual. I enjoy a game where a man makes me work. Thank you. Now to answer your question properly. Yes, I hustled pool in the past. It's not what I do now. I'm in business for myself, buying and selling things, but not the Brooklyn Bridge. As for the Spanish prisoner con, I've had it tried on me. I deal in the commodities market, grain futures and such. I do the same with stock margins, but I won't try to sell you anything. I'm neither a broker nor a bucket shop operator. Instead, I deal through established brokers. Oh yes, one more thing. I don't peddle tips. Give a man what seems to me a good tip, and he loses his shirt and blames me. So I don't. Mr. Bronson, I had no call to ask you about your business. That was nosy of me, but it was meant to be a friendly inquiry. I took it as friendly, so I wanted to give it a proper answer. Nosy, just the same. I don't need to know your background. That's just it, Mr. Johnson. I don't have a background. Pool hustler. Not much wrong with that. Pool is an open game like chess, difficult to cheat. Well, I do something that you might regard as cheating. Look, son, if you need a father or confessor, I can tell you where to find one. I am not one. Sorry. Didn't mean to be blunt, but do you have something on your mind? Or you do have something on your mind? Nothing much, perhaps. It has to do with having no background. None. So I go to church to meet people. To meet nice people, respectable people. People a man with no background otherwise could never meet. Mr. Bronson, everybody has some background. Lazarus turned down Benton Boulevard before answering. Not me, sir. Oh, I was born somewhere. Thanks to the man who let me call him grandfather and his wife, I had a pretty good childhood. But they're long gone, and shucks, I don't even know that my name is Ted Bronson. Happens. You're an orphan? I suppose so. And a bastard, probably. Is this the house? Lazarus stopped one house short of his/their home. Next one, with the porch light on. Lazarus eased the car forward, stopped again. Been nice meeting you, Mr. Johnson. Don't be in a hurry. These people. Bronson, who took care of you? Where was this? Bronson is a name I picked off a calendar. I thought it sounded better than Ted Jones or Ted Smith. I was probably born in the southern part of the state, but I can't prove even that. So, I practiced medicine down that way one time. What county? I know you did, Graham, so let's be careful with this one. Green County. I don't mean I was born there. I just mean I was told I came from an orphanage in Springfield. And I probably didn't deliver you. My practice was further north. Murph. But we might be kinfolk. Huh? I mean, Dr. Johnson? Don't call me doctor. Ted. I dropped that title when I quit delivering babies. But what I mean is this. When I first saw you, you startled me because you are the spitting image of my older brother Edward, who was an engineer on the St. Louis in San Francisco till he lost his air brakes and that ended his trifling ways. He had sweethearts in Fort Scott, St. Louis, Wichita, and Memphis. I have no reason to think he neglected Springfield. Could be. Lazarus grinned. Should I call you uncle? Suit yourself. Oh, I shan't. Whatever happened, there's no way to prove it. But that would be quite nice to have a family. Son, quit being self-conscious about it. A country doctor learns that such mishaps are far more common than most people dream. Alexander Hamilton and Leonardo da Vinci are both in the same boat with you, to name just two of the many great men entitled to wear the bend sinister. So stand tall and proud and spit in their eyes. I see the parlor light is still burning. What would you say to a cup of coffee? Oh, I wouldn't want to inconvenience you or disturb your family. It'll do neither. My daughter always leaves the pot on the back of the range for me. If she happens to be downstairs in a wrapper, unlikely, she'll go flying up the back stairs, then reappear instantly down the front stairs, dressed fit to kill, like a fire horse when the bell rings. I don't know how she does it. Come on in. Ira Johnson unlocked the front door, then called out as he opened, Maureen, I have company with me. Coming, Father. Mrs. Smith met them in the hall, moving with serene dignity and dressed as if she expected callers. She smiled, and Lazarus suppressed his excitement. Maureen, I want to present Mr. Theodore Bronson. My daughter, Ted, Mrs. Brian Smith. She offered his hand. You are most welcome, Mr. Bronson, Mrs. Smith said in warm, rich tones that made Lazarus think of Tamara. Lazarus took her hand gently, felt his fingers tingle, had to restrain himself from making a deep bow and kissing it. He forced himself only to give the hint of a bow, then let go at once. I am honored, Mrs. Smith. Do come in and sit down. Thank you, but it's late, and I was merely dropping your father off on my way home. Must you leave so quickly? I was simply darning stockings and reading the ladies' home journal. Nothing important. Maureen, I promised Mr. Bronson a cup of coffee. He fetched me home from the chess club and saved me a soaking. Yes, Father, right away. Take his hat and make him sit down. She smiled and left. Lazarus let his grandfather seat him in the parlor, then took advantage of the moments his mother was out of sight to quiet down and to glance around. Aside from the fact that the room had shrunk, it looked as much as he had remembered it. An upright piano she had taught him to play, fireplace with gas logs, mantel shelf with beveled mirror above, a glass-fronted sectional bookcase, heavy drapes.
Oh, my. Oh, this is a big river we're crossing now.
Or a bigger one, anyway.
That's great. That's great.
Heavy drapes and lace curtains. His parents' wedding picture framed with their hearts and flowers, marriage license. And balancing this, a reproduction of Millais' Gleaners, and other pictures large and small, a rocking chair, a platform rocker with a footstool, straight chairs, armchairs, tables, lamps, all crowded and in an easygoing mixture of mission oak and bird's eye maple. Lazarus felt at home. Even the wallpaper seemed familiar, save that he realized uneasily that he had been given his father's chair. An archway, filled by a boarded, beaded portier, led into the living room, now dark. Lazarus tried to call what should be in there, wondered if it would look just as familiar. The parlor was immaculately neat and clean, and kept that way, he knew, despite a large family, by the living room being used mainly by children, while this room was reserved for their elders and for guests. How many kids now? Nancy, Lynn Carroll, and Brian Jr., and George, and Marie, and himself. Since this would be early, this was early 1917, Dickie had to be about 3, and Ethel would still be in diapers. What was that behind my wooden mother's... What was that behind his mother's chair? Could it be? Yes, it's my elephant. What are you, little devil? You know you aren't supposed to play in here, and everything must go back into your toy box before you go up to bed. That's a flat rule. The toy animal was tall, about 6 inches high, made of stuffed cloth, and gray with much handling. Lazarus felt resentment that such a treasure, his, was entrusted to a younger child. A young child, then managed to laugh at himself, even though the emotion persisted. He felt tempted to steal the toy. Excuse me, you were saying, Mr. Johnson? I said I was temporarily delegated into loco parentis. My son-in-law has gone to Plattsburgh, and... Lazarus lost the rest of the remark. Mrs. Smith returned in a soft rustle of satin petticoats, carrying a loaded tray. Lazarus jumped to relieve her of it. She smiled and let him. By golly, that was the Haviland china he had not been allowed to touch until he had gotten his first long pants. And the company coffee service, solid silver serving pot. Cream pitcher, sugar bowl and tongs, Columbian exhibition souvenir spoons, linen doilies, matching tea napkins, thin slices of pound cake, a silver dish of mints. How did you do this in 3 minutes or less? You're certainly doing the prodigal proud. No, don't be a fool, Lazarus. She's doing her father proud, entertaining his guest. You are a faceless stranger. Children all in bed? Inquired Mr. Johnson. All but Nancy, Mrs. Smith answered, serving them. She and her young man went to the Isis and should be home soon. Show was over half an hour ago. Is there any harm in their stopping for a Sunday? The ice cream parlor is on a brightly lit corner right where they catch their streetcar. A young girl shouldn't be out after dark without a chaperone. Father, this is 1917, not 1890. He's a fine boy, and I can't expect him to miss an episode of their serial. Pearl White and very exciting. Nancy tells me all about it, with a William S. Hart feature tonight, I understand. I would have enjoyed seeing that myself. Well, I've still got my shotgun. Oh, Lord, that's good. Father. I've still got my shotgun. Lazarus concentrated on remembering to eat cake with a fork. She's trying to bring me up, Gramps said grumpily. It won't work. I'm sure Mr. Bronson is not interested in our family problems, Mrs. Smith said quietly. If they were problems, which they are not. May I warm your coffee, Mr. Bronson? Thank you, ma'am. That's right, he isn't. But Nancy should be told soon. Maureen, take a close look at Ted. Ever seen him before? His mother looked over her cup at Lazarus, put it down, and said, Mr. Bronson, when you came in, I had the oddest feeling. At church, was it not? Lazarus admitted that such could be the case. Gramps' brows shot up. So, I must warn the parson, but even if you did meet there... We did not meet at church, Father. What with hurting my zoo, I barely had time to speak to Reverend and Mrs. Draper. But now that I think about it, I'm sure I saw Mr. Bronson there last Sunday. One does notice a new face among old familiar ones. Daughter, as may be, that wasn't what I meant. Whom does Ted look like? No, never mind. Doesn't he look like your Uncle Ned? His mother again looked at Lazarus. Yes, I see a resemblance, but he looks even more like you, Father. No, Ted's from Springfield. All my sins were further north. I like him. He's good. Father, daughter, quit worrying about me rattling the family skeleton. It's possible that... Ted, may I tell it? Certainly, Mr. Johnson. As you said, it's nothing to be ashamed of, and I'm not. Sorry. Checking to make sure all the machinery is functioning. He's putting new batteries, that's good. Ted is an orphan, Maureen, a foundling. If Ned weren't warming his toes in hell, I'd ask him some searching questions. The time and place is right, and Ted certainly looks like our kin. Father, I think you are embarrassing our guest. I don't, and don't you be so hoity-toity, young lady. You're a grown woman with children. You can stand plain talk. Mrs. Smith, I'm not embarrassed. Whoever my parents were, I'm proud of them. They gave me a strong, healthy body and a brain that serves my needs. Well spoken, young man. And while I would be proud to claim your father as my uncle and you as my cousin if it were so, it seems more likely that my parents were taken by a typhoid epidemic down that way. The dates match well enough. Mr. Johnson frowned. How old are you, Ted? Lazarus thought fast and decided to be his mother's age. I'm 35. Why, that's just my age. Really, Mrs. Smith, if you hadn't made clear that you have a daughter old enough to go to the picture show with a young man, I would have thought you were about 18. Oh, go along with you. I have 8 children. Impossible. Maureen doesn't look her age, agreed her father. Hasn't changed since she was a bride. Runs in the family. Her mother doesn't have a gray hair today. Where is Grandma? Oh, yes, so don't ask. But Ted, you don't look 35 either. I would have guessed middle 20s. Well, I don't know exactly how old I am, but I can't be younger than that. I might be a little bit older. Quite a bit, Gramp. But it's close enough that when I'm asked, I just put down the 4th of July, 1882. Why, that's my birthday. Yes, Mama, I know. Really, Mrs. Smith? I didn't mean to steal your birthday. I'll move over a few days, say the 1st of July, since I'm not certain anyhow. Oh, don't do that. Father, you must bring Mr. Bronson home for dinner on our joint birthday. Do you think Brian would like that? Certainly he would. I'll write to him about it. He'll be home long before then in any case. You know Brian always says the more the merrier. We'll be expecting you, Mr. Bronson. Mrs. Smith, that's most kind of you. But I expect to leave on a long business trip on the 1st of July. I think you've let Father scare you off. Or is it the prospect of eating dinner with 8 noisy children? Never mind, my husband will invite you himself, and then we will see what you say. In the meantime, Maureen, stop crowding him. You've got him flustered. Let me see something. You two stand up, side by side. Go ahead, Ted, she won't bite you. Mrs. Smith? She shrugged and dimpled, then accepted his hand to get up out of a rocking chair. Father always wants to see something. Lazarus stood by her, facing his grandfather, and tried to ignore her fragrance, a touch of toilet water, but mostly the light, warm, delicious scent of sweet and healthy woman. Lazarus was afraid to think about it, was careful not to let it show in his face, but it hit him like a heavy blow. Both of you step up to the mantel and look at yourselves in the glass. Ted, there was no typhoid epidemic down that way in 82, nor 83. Really, sir? Of course I can't remember. And I shouldn't have tossed in that flourish. Sorry, Grant. Would you believe the truth? You might. Of all the men I've ever known. Don't risk it, bub. Forget it. Nope. Just the usual number of dumb fools, too lazy to build their privies a proper distance from their wells, which I feel certain could not describe your parents. Can't guess about your mother, but I think your father died with his hand on the throttle, still trying to gain control. Maureen? Mrs. Smith stared at her reflection and that of their guest. She said slowly, Father, Mr. Bronson and I look alike enough to be brother and sister. No, first cousins. Although with Ned gone, there's no way to prove it. I think... Mr. Johnson was interrupted by a yell from the front staircase landing. Mama, Gramp, I want to be buttoned up. Ira Johnson answered, "What are you, rapscallion? Get back upstairs." Instead, the child came down, small, male, freckled, and ginger-haired, dressed in Dr. Denton's, with the seat flapping behind him. He stared at Lazarus with beady, suspicious eyes. Lazarus felt a shiver run down his spine and tried not to look at the child. So this is a 2,000-year-old man encountering himself as he was at 4 years old.
Yes.
That's so queer. That's so incredibly queer. That's just so weird. That's so weird.
All the time paradoxes get... You get used to them after a while. But I remember that reaction.
Oh. Here comes the rain. It's neat. It's just queer. I think you asked me to remind you in some form or another to recall that heavier load on the car means greater momentum and all that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, especially when the ground is slippery.
Right, right. Okay. "Who's that?" the little boy asked. Mrs. Smith said quickly, "Forgive me, Mr. Bronson." Then she added quietly, "Come here, Woodrow." Her father said, "Don't bother, Marine. I'll take him up and blister his bottom, then I'll button him." "You and what six others?" the boy child demanded. "Me, myself, and a baseball bat." Mrs. Smith quietly and quickly attended to the child's needs, then hurried him out of the room and headed him up the stairs. She returned and sat down. Her father said, "Marine, that was just an excuse. Woody can button himself. And he's too old for that baby outfit. Put him in a nightshirt." "Father, shall we discuss it another time?" Mr. Johnson shrugged. "I've overstepped again. Ted, that one's the chess player. He's a stem winder. Named for President Wilson, but he's not too proud to fight. Mean little devil." "Father." "All right, all right. But it's true. That's what I like about Woody. He'll go too far. He'll go far, sorry. He'll go far." Mrs. Smith said, "Please excuse us, Mr. Bronson. My father and I sometimes differ a little about how to bring up a boy, but we should not burden you with it." "Marine, I simply won't let you make a little Lord Fauntleroy out of Woody." "There's no danger of that, Father. He takes after you. My father was in the War of 98, Mr. Bronson, and the insurrection, and the Boxer Rebellion, and he can't forget it." "Of course not. I keep my old Army 38 under my pillow, my son-in-law being away. Nor would I wish him to forget it. I'm proud of my father, Mr. Bronson, and hope that all my sons will grow up with his same spirit. But I want them to learn to speak politely, too." "Marine, I would rather have Woody sass me than be timid with me. He'll learn to speak politely soon enough. Older boys will take care of that. A lesson in manners punctuated with a black eye sticks. I know from experience." The discussion was interrupted by the jingle of the doorbell. "That should be Nancy," Mr. Johnson said, and got up to answer. Lazarus heard Nancy say goodnight to someone, then stood up himself to be introduced, and was not startled only because he had already picked out his eldest sister at church and knew that she looked like a young edition of Laz and Lore. How old are Laz and Lore supposed to be now? If Nancy's 17 and Laz and Lore older than...
Laz and Lore adults, because he said he wouldn't try the time travel until they
right.
were adults.
Okay. Okay. She spoke to him politely, but rushed upstairs as soon as she was excused. "Do sit down, Mr. Bronson." "Thank you, Mrs. Smith. But you were staying up until your daughter returned." "She has, so I will leave." "Oh, there's no hurry. Father and I are night owls." "Thank you very much. I enjoyed the coffee and the cake, and most especially the company. But it is time for me to say goodnight. You've been most kind." "If you must, sir, will we see you at church on Sunday?" "I expect to be there, ma'am." Lazarus drove home in a daze, body alert but thoughts elsewhere. He reached his apartment, bolted himself in, checked windows and blinds automatically, stripped off his clothes and started a tub. Then he looked grimly at himself in the bathroom mirror. "You stupid arsefarl," he said with a slow intensity. "You whirling son of a bitch, can't you do anything right?" No, apparently not, not even something as simple as getting reacquainted with his mother. Grandpa had been no problem, the old goat had given him no surprises. Other than being shorter and smaller than Lazarus remembered, he was just as grumpy, suspicious, cynical, formally polite, belligerent, and delightful as Lazarus had remembered. There had been worrisome moments when he had thrown himself on the mercy of the court, but that gambit had paid off better than Lazarus had any reason to hope. Though through an unsuspected family resemblance, Lazarus not only had never seen Graham's elder brother dead before Woody Smith was born, but he had forgotten there ever was an Edward Johnson. Was Uncle Ned listed with the families? Asked Justin. Never mind, not important. Mother had put her finger on the correct answer. Lazarus resembled his grandfather, and his mother, as Graham had pointed out, But that had resulted only in conjectures concerning dear old Uncle Ned and his trifling ways, ones that Mother did not mind listening to once she was certain that her guest was not embarrassed. Embarrassed? It had changed his status from stranger to cousin. Lazarus wanted to kiss Uncle Ned and thank him for those trifling ways that made kinship plausible. Grant believed the theory, of course it was his own, and his daughter seemed willing to treat it as a possible hypothesis. Lazarus, it's just the inside track you need if you weren't such a blithering idiot. He tested the bathwater, cold. He shut it off and pulled the plug. A promise of hot water all day long had been one inducement when Lazarus had rented this musty cave. But the janitor turned off the water heater before he went to bed, and anyone looking for hot water later than 9 was foolish. Well, he qualified as foolish, and perhaps cold water would do more good for his unstable condition than hot. But he had wanted a long hot soak to soothe his nerves and help him to think. He had fallen in love with his mother. Face it, Lazarus, this is impossible, and you don't know how to handle it. In more than 2,000 years of one silly misadventure after the other, this is the most preposterous predicament you ever got into. Oh, sure, a son loves his mother. As Woody Smith, Lazarus had never doubted that. He'd always kissed his mother goodnight, usually, hugged her when he saw her, if she wasn't in a hurry, remembered her birthday, almost always, thanked her for cookies or cakes she left out for him whenever he was out late, except when he forgot, and sometimes had told her he loved her. She had been a good mother. She had never screamed at him or at any of them, when necessary, had used a switch at once, and the matter was over with. Never that wait till your father gets home routine. Lazarus could still feel that peach switch on his calves. It had caused him to levitate, better than Thurston the Great, at a very early age. He recalled, too, that as he grew older, he found that he was proud of the way she looked, always neat and standing straight and invariably gracious to his friends, not like some of the mothers of other boys. Oh, sure, a boy loves his mother, and Woody had been blessed with one of the best. But this was not what Lazarus felt toward Maureen Johnson Smith, lovely young matron just his own age. That visit this night had been delicious agony, for he had never in all his lives been so unbearably attracted, so sexually obsessed by any woman, anywhere or when. During that short visit, Lazarus had been forced to be most careful not to let his passion show, and especially cautious not to appear too gallant, not to be more than impersonally polite, not by expression or tone of voice or anything else risk arousing Gramps' always alert suspicions, not let Gramps suspect the storm of lust that had raged up in him as soon as he had touched her hand. Lazarus looked down at the proof of his passion, hard and tall, and slapped it. What are you standing up for? There's nothing doing for you. This is the Bible Belt. It was indeed. Gramps did not believe in the Bible or live by Bible Belt standards, yet Lazarus felt sure that were he to provoke it by breaching those standards, Gramp would shoot him quite dispassionately on behalf of his son-in-law. Possibly the old man would let the first shot go wide and give him a chance to run, but Lazarus was not willing to bet his life on it. Gramp acting for a son-in-law might feel duty-bound to shoot straight, and Lazarus knew how straight the old man could shoot. Forget it. He was not going to give either Gramp or his father any reason to shoot, or even to be angry, and you forget it too, you blind snake. Lazarus wondered whether his father would be home. When his father would be home, and tried to remember how he looked. Found his memory blurred. Lazarus had always been closer to his grandfather Johnson than to his father, not only because his father had often been away on business, but also Gramp had been home in the daytime and willing to spend time with Woody. His other grandparents? Somewhere in Ohio. Cincinnati? No matter. His memory of them was so faint that it did not seem worthwhile to try to see them. He had completed all he intended to do in Kansas City, and if he had the sense, God promised a doorknob. The time is to leave is now. Skip church on Sunday, stay away from the pole hall, go down Monday and sell his remaining holdings and leave. Climb into the Ford. No, sell it and take a train to San Francisco. There can't catch the first ship south. Send Gramp and Maureen polite notes delivered from Denver or San Francisco saying that he was sorry about that business trip, etc. But get out of town. because Lazarus knew that the attraction had not been one-sided. He thought that he had kept Grant from guessing his emotional storm, but Maureen had been aware of it, and had not resented it. No, she had been flattered and pleased. They had been on the same frequency at once, and without a word or any meaningful glance or touch, her transponder had answered him, silently. Then, as opportunity made it possible, she had answered overtly, once with a dinner invitation which Gramp had trumped on, and she had promptly trumped back in a fashion that made it acceptable by the mores. Then a second time, just as he was leaving, with the also fully acceptable suggestion that she would expect to see him in church. Well, why should a young matron, even in 1917, not be pleased and flattered and unresentful to know that a man wanted most urgently to take her to bed and treat her with gentle roughness? If his nails were clean, if his breath was sweet, if his manners were polite and respectful, why not? A woman with 8 children is no nervous virgin. She is used to a man in her bed, in her arms, in her body, and Lazarus would have bet his last cent that Maureen enjoyed it. Lazarus had no reason then, or in his earlier life, to suspect that Maureen Smith had been anything but faithful by the most exacting Bible Belt standards. He had no reason to think that she was even flirting with him. Her manner had not suggested it. He doubted if it ever would. But he held a deep certainty that she was as strongly attracted as he was, that she knew exactly where it could lead, and he suspected that she realized that nothing but chaperonage would stop them. But a father in residence and 8 children, plus the contemporary mores concerning what can and can't be done, constituted a lot of chaperonage. Lita's chastity belt could hardly be more efficient. Let's haul it out in the middle of the floor and let the cat sniff it. Oh, that's a very good way to put it. Sin? Sin, like love, was a word hard to define. It came in 2 bitter but vastly different flavors. The first lay in violating the taboos of your tribe. This passion, he felt, was certainly sinful by the taboos of the tribe he had been born into, incestuous in the first degree. But it could not possibly be incestuous to Maureen. To himself, he knew that incest was a religious concept, not a scientific one, and the last 20 years had washed away in his mind almost every last trace of his tribal taboo. What was left was no more than that breath of garlic in a good salad. It made Maureen more enticingly forbidden, if such was possible. It did not scare him off. Maureen did not seem to be his mother, because she did not fit his recollection of her either as a young woman or as an old woman. The other meaning of sin was easier to define because it was not clouded by the murky concepts of religion and taboo. Sin is behavior that ignores the welfare of others. Suppose he stuck around and managed somehow, stipulate safe opportunity, to bed Maureen with her full cooperation. Would she regret it later? Adultery? The word meant something here. But she was a Howard, one of the early ones when marriage between Howards was a cash contract, eyes wide open, payment from the foundation for each child born of such union. And Maureen had carried out the contract, 8 paid-for children already, and would stay in production for about 15 years more. Perhaps to her, adultery meant violation of contract rather than sin. He did not know. But that is not the point, Bob. The real question is the only one that has ever stopped you when temptation coincided with opportunity, and this time he could consult neither Ishtar nor any geneticist. The chance of a bad outcome was slight when there were so many hurdles in the way of any outcome, but it was the exact risk he had always refused to take, the chance of placing a congenital handicap on a child.
Oh, man. Jesus.
I understand that one. Hey, wait a minute. No such outcome could result because no such had resulted. He knew every one of his siblings, alive now or still reborn, and there had not been a defective in the lot, not one. Therefore, no hazard. But that was grounded on the assumption that his no paradoxes theory was a law of nature. But you've long been aware that the no paradoxes theory itself involves a paradox, one that you've kept quiet about so as not to alarm Laz and Laura and the rest of your present, that present, not this one, family. To wit, the idea that free will and predestination are 2 aspects of the same mathematical truth, and the difference is merely linguistic, not semantic. The notion that his own free will could not change events here and now because his free will actions here and now are already a part of what had happened in any later here and now, which in turn depended on a solipsistic notion he had held as far back as he could remember. Cobwebs, all of it. Lazarus, you don't know what trouble you might cause, so don't. Get out of town now and don't come back to Kansas City at all. because if you do, you're certain to try to get out, get Maureen's bloomers off, and she's going to breathe hard and help. From there on, only Allah knows, but it could be tragic for her and tragic for others, and as for you, you stupid stud, all balls and no brain, you could get your ass shot off, just as the twins predicted. In which case, since you are not going to see your family again, there is no sense in waiting in South America for this war to end. You've seen enough of this doomed era. Ask the girls to come pick you up now. Was her waist really that slender, or did she lace it in? Shucks, it didn't matter how she was built. As with Tamara, it simply did not matter. Dear Laz and Lore, he wrote, darlings, I've changed plans. I've seen my first family, and there isn't anything else I want to do in this era. Nothing worth sweating out more most of 2 years in a backwater while this war drags on to its bloody and useless finish. So I want you to pick me up now at the impact crater. Forget about Egypt. I can't get there now. By pick me up now, I mean Gregorian 3, March 1917. Repeat. Third day of March, 1917, Gregorian, at that meteor impact crater in Arizona. Much to tell you when I see you. Meanwhile, my undying love, Lazarus. Was it her voice? Or her fragrance? Or something else? End of chapter.
So vehicles over 4 tons, surely a truck is over 4 tons.
It's 6:22 p.m., mile 635. We just right now, a little bit ago, passed across the Ohio border. We've been driving now for 25 hours and have traveled 635 miles. And, we've been traveling for 25 hours and 635 miles and it's now 6:22 p.m.
Daniel X with Commander Q.
36 XUIF Commander Q.
36 X with Commander Q. Train.
And spirit long,
To a Skylark, Percy Shelley. Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, that from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art. Higher still and higher from the earth thou springest, like a cloud of fire, the blue deep thou wingest, and singing still dost soar, and soaring ever singest. In the golden lightning of the sunken sun, o'er which clouds are brightening, thou dost float and run, like an unbodied joy whose race is just begun. The pale purple even melts around thy flight, like a star of heaven in the broad daylight. Thou art unseen, but yet I hear thy shrill delight. Keen as are the arrows of that silver sphere, whose intense lamp narrows in the white dawn clear until we hardly see. We feel that it is there. All the earth and air, with thy voices loud, as when night is bare, from one lonely cloud, the moon rains out her beams, and heaven is overflowed. What thou art, we know not. What is most like thee? From rainbow clouds there flow not drops so bright to see, as from thy presence showers a rain of melody. Like a poet hidden in the light of thought, singing hymns unbidden till the world is wrought to sympathy with hopes and fears it heeded not. Like a high-born maiden in a palace tower, soothing her love-laden soul in secret hour with music sweet as love, which overflows her bower. Like a glowworm golden in a dell of dew, scattering unbeholden its aerial hue among the flowers and grass which screen it from the view. Like a rose embowered in its own green leaves, by warm winds deflowered till the scent it gives makes faint with too much sweet those heavy-winged thieves. Sound of vernal showers on the twinkling grass, rain-awakened flowers, all that ever was, joyous and fresh and clear, thy music doth surpass. Teach us, sprite or bird, what sweet thoughts are thine. I have never heard praise of love or wine that panted forth a flood of rapture so divine. Chorus hymeneal or triumphal chant, matched with thine would be all but an empty vaunt, a thing wherein we feel there is some hidden want. What objects are the fountains of thy happy strain? What fields or waves or mountains? What shapes of sky or plain? What love of thine own kind? What ignorance of pain? With thy clear, keen joyance, languor cannot be. Shadow of annoyance never came near thee. Thou lovest, but ne'er knew love's sad satiety. Waking or asleep, thou of death must deem things more true and deep than we mortals dream. Or how could thy notes flow in such a crystal stream? We look before and after and pine for what is not. Our sincerest laughter with some pain is fraught. Our sweetest songs are those which tell of saddest thought. Yet if we could scorn hate and pride and fear, if we were things born not to shed a tear, I know not how thy joy we ever should come near. Better than all measures of delightful sound, better than all treasures that in books are found, thy skill to poet were, thou scorner of the ground. Teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow. The world would listen then, as I'm listening now.
Go Skylark. So here is a poem I wrote about the first time I ever heard a skylark singing. It was at Sunrise Celebration Festival 2007. Sky larking. A smile on my face. Someone is trying to fuck with my head. There are computer birds outside the tent, undulating, looping phrases like a dialing modem crossed with a raver's whistle. Pop and beep and sizzle in the sky, sometimes seeming to answer the sounds of the stages, pumping beats, blips and basses, sometimes singing amongst themselves. Sunrise elves manifest from the excess energy in my brain and crawl from my conspiratorial ears to erect small speakers on poles, playing computer birds' rhythmic blippeeping rhymes, repeating phrases in perfect time, syncing with the music of this small city of the sun. They are making too much sense to me. I understand the virtues of their music. This must be trickery. I can hear them twist and groove it. Some human hand wrote the program that writes these chip bird songs. My senses have been heightened, but my conclusion may be wrong. Perhaps they are simply sensible, conscious little animals, celebrating with songs that speak across the seas between species. Wake up! It's another beautiful day. They are not computer birds, and life is not a game. Some little part of my soul and theirs is the same.
You're listening to The Metaphor Reel with DJ Sam Knott on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting round the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
Because I was afraid to speak when I was just a lad, me father gave me nose a tweak and told me I was bad. But then one day I learned a word that saved me aching nose, the biggest word you ever heard, and this is how it goes. Oh, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, underlie. He traveled all around the world and everywhere he went, he'd use his word and all would say, there goes a clever gent.
When dukes and maharajas pass his time a day with me, I say me special word and then they ask me out to tea.
Woo! Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious,
underlie.
Of course you can always say it backward, which is docious aliexpialisticfragicalirufus, but that's going a bit too far, don't you think?
Indubitably.
So when the cat has got your tongue, there's no need for dismay. Just summon up this word and then you've got a lot to say, but better use it carefully or it can change your life.
One night I said it to me girl, now me girl's me wife.
She's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.